Session number 14620, Reel 3.
Major Smith, Reel 3.
Yes, these German POWs were volunteers for the job. They got a bit of extra pay for it, and they got the heavy ration supplement, which all bomb disposal chaps got, on top of army rations. They were a good bunch. Some were rabid Nazis and were Bolshy, but some were Slavs, displaced persons and so on, or were Ukrainians, or were from odd parts of Europe and they didn't particularly want to go back to. So they were a mixed bunch, but by and large they were good, willing workers, and they worked as a team, and they identified with their British corporal and Lance Corporal or whoever was in charge of them and working with them, and a mutual respect sprung up between them, and they worked well together. Many of them stayed on after they were released from prisoner of war status and worked as voluntary workers for the army in bomb disposal.
Any of the bombs that you dealt with in those early days in Bristol that you stick out?
Yes, we had a particularly difficult one at a place called Washing Pool Lane, Avonmouth. This bomb kept disappearing. I mentioned briefly how we could locate bombs more accurately with the modern bomb locator we had. And we, in fact, located the bomb at about 18 feet down. Now, in Avonmouth, the ground consists of about 12 to 14 feet of reasonably good, hard, firm ground with probably an element of clay in it. But below that, you get into running sand and silt, which is very wet. Now, the usual drill was to timber our shaft to keep the sides up, obviously, and then continue until we hit this running sand. Now, as the running sand was so fluid, we had to resort to sheet steel piling, which we drove down in a square around the known position of the bomb. The sheet piling was impervious and kept out the kept the sides, the sand and water out fairly well, but nonetheless it still was wet at the bottom and we had to keep pumping continuously. So we dug down to the bomb, and in fact I was actually able to prod it with the bomb probe, and it was only virtually a foot or so below where we were digging. Overnight the bottom of the shaft bubbled up, and when we went back next morning all the sand and stuff we dug out had all come back in again. So off we went and started digging again. And when we probed, we found the bomb had slipped down to about 20 feet. So we drove the piles a bit deeper. We dug down a bit deeper. And because the running sand was kept coming in almost as fast as we could pump it out, and of course the sand was very gritty, so it wore out the pumps very quickly, and we had to keep changing the pumps. Kept our fitters busy putting new impellers and bushes on the pumps. I was actually on the job down in a hole. In fact, I had my hand on the bomb. I could feel it through the slime and sand and stuff in the bottom. And then one of the timber wailings started to creak and crack, and Corporal Ashford, who was with me, said, "Look, this chap's collapsing." He said, "Get out, get out, get out." So we shinned up the ladder quick and got out, and as we watched, the bottom of the shaft just bubbled up again, and the shaft distorted and virtually collapsed. When we eventually could get down there and probed, the bomb had slipped even deeper. So, nothing for it but to pull out all the piling, backfill the shaft, taking care to leave a pipe on the bomb so we knew where it was. We could bonk, 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 feel where it was. We left the pipe there and backfilled around it, left the ground to consolidate for a week or so, and then we put a new shaft down and started all over again. And this went on and on and on, and it went on until eventually I left the unit. And this was, oh, probably about a year or so later before we finally got to it. And I believe that my successor had to eventually put a small little shaft of piling around the bomb and pump concrete underneath the bomb to stop it slipping any further. Then they finally got it out. Go there today, there's an oil installation on the site, so it's necessary to remove it anyway. You know, there it was.
Any other bombs from that period that stick out?
Yes, but not for the story of the bomb. What happened to me? We were working on a bomb at a farm near Hallen, and we were in good terms with the farmer, which was unusual. Sometimes they didn't like us digging up their ground. And we're talking to the farmer. He said, well, there's another one up there, you know. So I said, what? And this was quite often the way we found out about bombs. He said, oh, yeah, it's up in the next field. So I said, well, come on, show me. So he took me up to this field a bit further on than the one we were working on. And he said, it's around here somewhere. So I noted carefully where it was and made a point to go and use our bomb locator and see if we could find it. In fact, later we did find it and get it out. Anyway, walking back to the farm, he said, come and have a drink. So we went into an outhouse and he had three huge barrels. They were pipes of port, you know, that apparently he got from Harvey's of Bristol. And he made cider himself from his own apples in his own orchard. So he said, yeah, what do you think of this, lad, you know, and gave me a big glass of almost colourless liquid tasting strongly of apples. Oh, quite nice, quite refreshing. It was a hot, sunny day, and oh, it was really refreshing. And he said, well, what about this one then? And he tried another barrel. Look at that. Oh, that's a better colour, isn't it? Yes, try some of that. Yeah, good, yeah. Then, of course, this one is a bit older and it's matured a bit better. You know, this is a nice one, this one. Try this. Oh, yeah, I like that one. Great. Have another one. So, and we natted on and we had a few more jars of this raw cider. And I remember going back to my truck, my utility, saying to the driver, righto, Parsons, back to camp. And I don't remember anything else till the next morning. But I'm told that I got back to camp, went into the office, and our OC used to have an O group every night about quarter past, half past five. We all sat round the room, and he'd go round the room asking each of us to report on progress on the day's work or whatever. And it came to my turn, and apparently I said, BSL 485 or whatever the number of the job was, I reported what had happened, and I reported that there was a possibility of another bomb in the next field and I would investigate it in due course. And apparently my colleague said I was perfectly lucid, but I can't remember a single thing about it. Complete wipeout. So don't drink raw cider from Somerset farmers, is my advice.
You were telling me earlier off the record something which, if you could put on the tape now to repeat, about how people during the war got the impression that a bomb had exploded when it hadn't. Can you repeat what you were saying about that, please?
Yes, a large bomb weighing about a ton or perhaps even more, hitting a building will cause considerable damage to that building, obviously. It falls a long way through the air, got a high velocity when it hits the building. It weighs a great amount, and it can cause devastating damage. Similarly, if a large bomb hits soft ground, it will make a crater just from its impact with the ground. This is known in the trade as a splash crater. And in the early days of the war, quite a number of bombs were reported as exploded because there was a crater or because of the damage. It wasn't until people became more experienced that it was realized that this splash crater and this impact damage was just due to the impact and not to an explosion, that it was realized that somewhere the bomb was still sitting there unexploded. And then, of course, the search was on to find the bomb. Of course, several years may have passed, and the traces of where the bomb had gone made it rather difficult to find it. But quite a number of bombs recovered after the war were a result of this type of incident.
You were saying earlier that the Bristol area had been particularly badly hit.
Yes, indeed.
Was it mostly around Avonmouth and Portishead?
No, I would say almost the whole of Bristol was bombed. One of the first jobs I was involved with when I went to Bristol was a bomb underneath the Labour Exchange in Prince Street, Bristol. The bomb had actually fell into the road, but it had jinked, as we call it, and travelled horizontally underneath the foundations of the building. If you go to Prince Street now and look at the wall of the Labour Exchange, you will see the brickwork is slightly different in place, which indicates where we managed to demolish part of the wall in the course of our operation. Most of my jobs were in the Avonmouth area because a lot of them were abandoned bombs, largely due to these ground conditions that I outlined previously, you know, this solid ground down to about 12 feet and then running sand and silt below that.
Any other bombs of particular difficulty apart from that Washingpole Lane bomb?
No, the others were more or less routine, straightforward jobs, and we had the technique of doing a timber approach shaft through the good, hard, firm ground, and then sitting inside that a smaller sheet steel piling shaft.
Which was the bomb disposal company you were with there?
Number 7 Bomb Disposal Squadron.
And this was in about 47 you were doing the work?
This was in 47, yes.
Where did you go to after Bristol?
Well, I intended getting married, and my girlfriend lived up in Sunderland. And there was a bomb disposal squadron at East Bolden, which is only 3 or 4 miles from Sunderland. So I, on the grapevine, I found out there were vacancies there, so I asked if I could transfer. And I was allowed to. I think one of the reasons was that by this time I'd become, in quotes, experienced, in as much as I'd had a few bombs to deal with. And apparently 20 Squadron, due to demobs and whatever, had lost their experienced people. So I think I was allowed to go because I was experienced, for what it's worth.
Was there much unexploded bomb work in that area?
Not a lot, no. I did a job at a place called Burradon in Northumberland. This was a bomb near the Corrie Welfare building somewhere, Burradon. Then another one that was rather a funny one was on a slag heap at Dorman Long Steelworks, a place called Lackenby near Middlesbrough.
It had sunk into the slag heap?
That had gone in, yes, and the trouble was, because of the ferrous nature of the slag, it was very difficult to locate the bomb. But somehow or other, my predecessors had located it and were actually digging for it when I took the job over. We got that one out.
Was that a big one?
250 kilo, I think, if I remember correctly. I went looking for a bomb in the River Tyne near the Fish Quay at North Shields. That had fallen into the mud just off the river bank, and I tried using the bomb locator, but there's so much scrap metal and rubbish, old ship's anchors, all sorts of rubbish. I never did find that one, so it's probably still there somewhere. Near the pickled onion factory, I always remember that foul smell that came from the pickled onion factory. I think it was owned by Tyne Foods.
Did you ever come across bombs with booby traps on them in Britain?
No. See, after the war, I don't want to go into all the design of German fuses, but basically there were three or four basic types. First was the normal impact fuse. Now, in 1946-47, subsequently, impact fuses were safe as fuses. Then there was the delay fuses. These were a clockwork fuse. Now, these were potentially always hazardous, because you never knew whether A, the clock had never started, B, the clock had started and run and then stopped, or whether C, the clock had run its course almost, but it just hadn't gone off, and D, the clockwork fuse nearly always had an anti-withdrawal device underneath it, so that if you try to pull it out, it set the bomb off. So there you were, that was the clockwork fuse. Then they were introduced later on in the war, anti-disturbance fuses. When the Germans learned that we could deal with their impact and clockwork fuses fairly routinely, they then put a device which had a very fine trembler switch, so that any impact or shock would set the bomb off. Then again, our people evolved a technique for dealing with that fuse, discharging it so that the electric condensers discharged and the fuse was made safe. They then got round that by slipping some batteries into the fuse instead of electric condensers. That made it more hazardous. However, by 1947, these fuses had, over the course of time, discharged themselves, and they were no longer really a hazard. There were other fuses that enabled things like air burst to be achieved, you know, to make the bomb burst above the ground to attack against troops in the open, in the field, and that sort of thing. They were very seldom met. There were also short delay fuses that allowed a bomb to penetrate through a ship's deck into the inside of a ship or into a hardened building before exploding. But these are just routine sort of things, so they weren't a problem. The hazards came after the war in a number of ways. First of all, the fuse had underneath it some booster pellets. Can you imagine the fuse pocket being transverse across the bomb? There's pictures in the book if you care to look it up. And these pellets were made of picric acid. Over time, and with the possible ingress of moisture, these picric acid pellets could dissolve, could dry out again, and reform what were called picrates. And these could be sensitive to friction, so that if you pull the fuse out, you could, in fact, initiate explosion by just doing that. So it was always essential that you did all the fuse removals and whatever by remote control, even after the war. There were times when that wasn't possible, but that's another story. There were special cases. The other problem was the clockwork fuse, which was always a hazard, and is always, even today, if they find one with a clock, it's still a hazard. The other anti-disturbance fuses should not be a problem today, and in fact I never came across one that was.
Any other bombs in the Sunderland area that stick out in your mind?
Yes and no. What happened round about this time was that the bomb disposal squadrons started to run down. After the war, they were running down. A number 20 squadron was disbanded and merged with number 1 squadron, which was headquartered in the south of Nottingham. But basically, I stayed put with my troop. All we did was change our name. One day we were 20 squadron, the next day we were 1 squadron. And then in its turn, 1 squadron disappeared, and we became 16 squadron with headquarters in Winchester and the famous Bill Hartley as my OC. Quite good for a young officer to be 300 miles from his headquarters with his own troop of 250 odd men scattered around the north of England in a number of separate detachments and an operational responsibility for several bombs and a few minefields. The sort of thing which officers today, even of quite senior rank, seldom have this sort of responsibility. My parish was the whole of Northern Command and the whole of Scottish Command. So any incidents of enemy bombs or beach minefields anywhere in that area would be down to me to deal with. I had the small Austin or Hillman utility as my personal transport, but I was doing such great mileages that I would wear them out after about 10,000 miles. So they gave me a staff car. So there was I, Lieutenant Temporary Captain, riding around in a high-powered Humber staff car, much to the chagrin and dismay of some of the senior officers, particularly of the King's Dragoon Guards, who were quartered on the airfield across the road from us.
Can you tell me about the bombs in the East Riding that you dealt with, please, in as much detail?
Yes, by this time I was stationed in Hutton Cranswick near Driffield, and we had a bomb at a place called Watton Cars, which is low-lying meadowland down near the River Hull. This bomb was in marshy ground and it required sheet steel piling, and eventually no great problem, we got it out, except we had a lot of pumps working away and we had problems getting the equipment across the marshes to the site. The debacle came when we finished the job and we were recovering the equipment. We had a 19 Ruston Bucyrus crane that was used for pile driving, for handling these sheet steel piles, which weighed about 500 weights apiece. And having got the piles out, we then loaded them onto a 10-ton lorry to take them away, and we constructed a trackway of timber across the field to the hardened farm track. The lorry managed to skid off the wooden track into the mud and sank down, right down to its platform level, wheels completely buried. So the corporal, great initiative, brought the crane up. But instead of the crane tracks were a bit wider than the vehicle tracks, so the corporal laid some more timbers next to the existing timber track we made. But he laid them long ways. So when the crane ran onto the timbers, the whole lot just sank down into the mud. And I came back to the site. And as I came through the gate of the field, I saw the 10-ton truck sunk down to its platform, loaded as it was with these heavy steel piles in the mud. The crane, with its caterpillar tracks, completely buried in the mire, too, and tilted over at a dangerous angle. What do you do now? So, I set the chaps on to excavate around the crane so that we could drag it out. And I went off to see the War Agricultural Executive Committee. These were set up by the Ministry of Agriculture during the war, and asked him if he had any advice on how to do things. And the chap was very helpful. He said, "Yeah, sure." And he lent me two things called Trujillo winches, which are little compact ratchet winches with steel wire cables. So we dug down and slipped some timber down for the crane to come onto, and we made a hole fast and fastened the winches to it and dragged the crane out, taking great care to lay the timbers like railway sleepers across the line of the track this time. And having got the crane out, we then made another track, took the crane up, unloaded the lorry, lifted the lorry back onto the track. And then by moving the crane to swing the piles down, place it, then move the crane up and pick them up and swing it round again, we eventually got everything out and the site cleared. But that took weeks and weeks to do that. My OC wasn't pleased at all. Gave me a hard time over that, as if it was my fault. And it was the middle of winter, it was cold, it was wet, and you know what East Yorkshire can be like that time of the year.
Was this about 49?
Yes, it was indeed, yeah.
Can you tell me about the bomb at Roos, Sunderland Farm?
Yes, this was another steel piling job. Ground very bad. I took it over after it had been started. This famous Dickie Richard had been involved with it. And we just carried on, and eventually we got it out. No great problem, that job.
That wasn't a stick of bombs then?
Well, it was, and I believe the unit went back later, several years later, and had a go at another one that was